Welcome to Turning Point, a podcast dedicated to sharing the always inspiring, sometimes heartbreaking stories of people working in the social services profession. We'll be hearing stories of triumph over incredible odds, as well as the setbacks and challenges that people face along the way. We'll hear from people working in addiction and mental health, residential treatment programs, and community-based services, as well as some of the clients that those people serve. We'll be focusing on how to increase your impact as a professional and the role of helping people overcome their own challenges through stories of impactful moments, both in treatment and in life. We'll hear tips, tools, strategies, and resources that you can apply to your own practice starting today. Turning Point is brought to you by Enviros, a diverse social services organization dedicated to strengthening youth and families in Alberta through a unique and powerful combination of experiential, strengths-focused, family-centered programming. You can learn more at www.enviros.org. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Coulard.
Pleasure to be here. Really nice day. I listened to some David Bowie on the way in.
Nice.
Which is,
it's a good day.
Start a day.
Welcome to this week's episode of Turning Point. This week we've got Chris Sullivan, supervisor at our YTA Youth Transitions to Adulthood program. Chris has been at Enviros for more than 12 years in a wide range of programs, and we have a great conversation about his perspective on the work, what they do in YTA, his advice for young staff. We cover lots of territory, so enjoy and let me know what you think.
Yeah. So can you tell me a bit about your role at Enviros, what you do? And maybe a bit of the history of how you came into that role.
The history of my role?
Yeah.
My role, I'm the current supervisor of the Youth Transitions to Adulthood program. And I've been in that position for... I actually don't entirely know.
It's been a while.
It's been a while, but it's been a nice while. You know, it's not one where I'm counting time at all because I really enjoy it. So I think I'd say 5 years, I think. Must be four.
That's gotta be at least that, 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
And before that, you were?
Before that, I was a YTA worker for 2 years, let's say. Before that, I was a foster care support worker. Before that, I was an Excel worker. And before that, I was a base camp worker.
You've almost done the full.
I've been around.
Full gamut.
Been around.
How long now? 10 years.
Yeah, no. What are we at? 16. Mm-hmm. 12. 12 years this June.
Wow.
Yep.
That makes you an Enviros lifer.
Big deal.
big deal.
Yeah, I've got a knife and a cup.
Yeah.
No sweater. But yeah. So yeah, no, I've been around for a while. Base camp was a great jump in, you know. I got to do 4 seasons of base camp, which you get the full cross section of what goes on at base camp if you've got 4 seasons.
Yep.
When we went to Excel, it was when we started the female young offender program. So it was myself and Nathan Miller, and then a bunch of ladies. So it was an interesting program to be male in and start up. There was some concern just around our fit, but it worked out really well. So that was a really good program. My time in foster care, I learned a lot about success and frustration. And was there for a year and, year and three quarters. And then YTA was sort of my fit. I'd always pursued YTA, like even from base camp. I remember applying, like trying to interview or interviewing for it.
Yeah.
And had always been going after that position.
So tell me a bit about YTA and why the attraction and what the work looks like in that program.
So as a YTA worker, you're it's really one-to-one weekly meetings, sometimes a couple meetings in a week. You've got your clients in and around the city, they're as far south as Staveley or east in Strathmore, north in north of Airdrie even, never Canmore, unfortunately, or Banff. I think we had one kid that was there, but everybody scrambled for that kid. and so you meet up and you're identifying their needs with them. And assisting them in transitioning to adulthood. So that's anywhere from, kids who are successfully moving from high school grad into post-secondary and just need a bit of assistance with that transition to those who are struggling with addiction and mental health and can't graduate and all of those factors.
And these are kids who are in the child welfare system.
Yeah, they all have status, official, you know, permanent guardianship orders or temporary or any sort of government status. So we act kind of as a liaison, a bridge between the worker who's appointed to the kid and the kid, which is good because the workers don't have the time or capacity necessarily to do what needs to get done with these clients.
Cool. And what are some of the biggest challenges that youth face transitioning out of government care at some level into adulthood? What are some of the commonalities? You mentioned addiction and mental health.
Yeah.
But you also mentioned transitioning into college and university. Is there anything that stands out to you as something that you guys do a lot of?
Well, I think the biggest thing is just the actual, if we all look back at the time when we were transitioning into adulthood, you know, in our own experiences, the challenges that came across were so broad, like they're really hard to pinpoint down one particular thing that's a commonality between youth other than just learning how to not be a kid anymore.
Yeah.
The problem with youth in care is that they don't, and this isn't to say people who grew up with families have that, you know, one step ahead, that learning that, but the kids that are in care who've been through group homes and foster care and whatnot, they've lacked that. They haven't had that support, the same level of support, ideally, that we people with families on the norm have. And I think that's, you know, it delays them developmentally and emotionally. It delays their preparedness to transition because of any lack of valuable lesson that may have been missed. Yeah. At the age of 7 or whatever, you know. Right. What I mean? I think our biggest challenge is determining possibly what was missed, because they don't know.
Right.
You have to figure it out. It's not like, when I was 7, I didn't learn how to say please and talk to people on the telephone, you know? So you get to figure those interesting little things out, which surprisingly, you know, the anxiety that's induced with the idea of having to go in and talk to a stranger to open a bank account is really big, you know, in a lot of youth, or having an appropriate phone conversation when you're trying to get your needs met is really big because you haven't really learned how to verbalize those things.
Yeah.
Which,
And do you guys have a process for identifying those needs, or is there something you guys do to get that figured out? I imagine, given the breadth of that, you could be shooting in the dark.
Oh, absolutely. And sometimes we are shooting in the dark. But so the client comes in and their worker, their government-appointed worker, we meet all together. And just to make sure that the client themselves are a good fit, like if they want the program, because it's a voluntary program. The worker ideally knows who they're working with. They know the kid. But a lot of, sometimes they just don't, or there's just that disconnect relationally between them, so there's no kind of consciousness around what the needs are. But ideally, the kid can give us some idea around their experiences, and depending on their level of honesty or where they're at in their own capacity to trust people, tell them what's really going on. And we'll kind of just triage from there. Like, you know, if housing's an issue, obviously we're going to start with that one first, you know. Get your basic supports and needs met. Some include food, clothing, shelter, and go from that point. You get a sense like, are you in school? No. Okay. Well, why? And then you just start breaking it apart.
Yeah.
Do you have drug problems? Okay. Why? Where are these from? And that's actually a really challenging one though, because if they're not prepared to talk about it or deal with it, then that's really going to get in the way of a lot of things.
It's going to be an obstacle for
that
transition, for sure.
Yeah.
Cool. So it's interesting. I think you've probably got an interesting perspective on the care system that we have developed in society for kids, because you're seeing them at the tail end of it, and mm-hmm. you're seeing all of these needs that are maybe unmet, or these experiences that haven't been met.
Yeah.
So what would you advise to the group homes and the foster care placements and the social workers who are caring for these kids from an early age to to the time that you see them at, I don't know, 15, 16, 17, 18? I don't know what age range you get.
Yeah, we go 15 and a half to 25
okay.
now.
So given some of those things that you guys are working on, what should we be doing differently?
I think first and foremost, we as a whole society slash, you know, social worker type need to remember who we're dealing with. And it always, when I realize this, it struck me as like, wow, like we forget that these people are kids, and our expectations of these individuals are way higher probably than what we would place on our own kids or what was placed on us. Because somehow we've made a job market out of it. And so we're looking for outcomes and results. But they're actually just people, small people, who have even, you know, more struggles and challenges than other people, right? So to stack expectations that are not realistic or possible on them really is of great detriment. Yeah, I think that group homes and foster parents and YTA workers and social workers as a whole need to, like, just take a step back and look at who they're working with and think about things like teaching how to cook or do laundry or how to talk to people, how to engage people in the community, like going to Subway and ordering their own sandwich. You know, like I see a lot of kids who actually get uncomfortable ordering for themselves because it's been done for them.
Yeah.
Or they're just, we're never put in that situation to, you know. So I think, I think that we just need to be reasonable in our expectations need to be reasonable. And we need to remain engaged in what we should be working with them on appropriately to their age level.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting. On CBC just the other day, they were talking about curling parents, these mm-hmm. parents who sweep obstacles away right. from their kids.
Yeah.
And it got me reflecting on the system and how often helping can quickly become enabling.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like you say, ordering a sandwich for the kid
yeah.
or, you know, decreasing the barriers in their life doesn't necessarily build resiliency and doesn't build the skills that you need. And I think that society at large struggles with that these days. But I think that helping professionals, probably because they're helping professionals and they care, think they're doing the best thing for kids. But sometimes it doesn't lend itself to that kind of natural way of raising kids, which is to parent them.
Well, now that you say that, it's almost backwards because the parents that are sweeping and obstacle clearing and creating no barriers or discomfort for their children are like on one polar side, and then the 10-year-old in group homes that's expected to do, like, all of the challenging, crazy stuff is way over on the other side, right? And so, in fact, yeah, no, you're getting an even greater dichotomy between the two parties, which really would probably challenge them in hanging out later in life.
Yeah, we're always wrestling with that at base camp because we're working with teenagers mm-hmm. with addictions issues, and it's like, okay, what's normal teenage behavior
yeah.
and what's addiction behavior? Because
yeah.
sometimes them just being a jerk or obnoxious,
yeah.
that's just normal teenage
yeah.
behavior. And we set the bar really, really high sometimes.
Yeah.
And I think it's unrealistic.
Yeah.
And we run into that on a regular basis.
Oh, absolutely. You know, because you're going to get triggers and all types of magic. But, I think it's super important. You know, I did a foster parent training a little while ago. And, you know, my biggest message is just remember who you're dealing with. Like, they need to be engaged and they need to be challenged and they need to be uncomfortable, but they also need to be loved and nurtured too because they're just people.
Yeah.
Right? So, yeah, it's a funny balance.
Yeah. Cool. Can you tell me a story of a client that sticks out for you from any of your experiences at Enviros? From YTA to base camp to foster care.
Yeah.
That stands out as a success, as someone who either transitioned into adulthood really well or did well at Excel, or, you know, whatever pops out for you.
Yes. I've worked with many people who lie repeatedly for extended periods of time. And that's a very frustrating thing to know that you're being lied to by a client and you get to just have to, you get to figure out their lies. But it's really hard to make a relationship with a liar kid. That being said, some of my best relationships have been with liar kids, because I really appreciate the development of a relationship with a kid, really, no matter the circumstance. But the liar kids are really so good at not having a relationship, and just hiding because of distrust and experience and all of that. And so when you really break through with a liar kid, it's taken a lot of time and effort and trust building. I worked, again, with many who it was like, oh, I go to school. And no, you don't go to school. Or I'm not doing drugs. Yeah, you do so much drugs. You know, it's just storytelling. And you're just becoming a detective to figure out what's true and what's not. So, yeah, a kid, she cannot graduate high school. She can't even go to high school. She just cannot get there. She's moving around all over the city, different schools. And finally, unfortunately, the pressure came when she was turning 18. And they're like, well, the government wanted to close her file. You're done. And so you're not going to get any more supports. And that was the turning point. But she, you know, I'd say a couple months before that came along, like, we'd actually really started working together. And we'd been working together. It was like a year and a half of lying and me hunting after truths. But, you know, she also came across as an individual who had great capacities and was a really great person. Just told a lot of stories. So, yeah, she ended up graduating high school, getting into some post-secondary. Didn't go all the way through it, but, you know, had come. She went into foster care when she was 4. Had been in, like, 8 group homes.
Wow.
You know, this sort of thing. She was opinionated and strong-minded. And really, you know, had her own agenda going on. And that's how it worked for her. And that's how people never met her. Because she's a kid and adults are right and kids not necessarily. She fought through a lot, and inevitably, you know, we're still in touch, and she's doing well as a young, you know, mid-20s person, which is super rad. But yeah, it took a long time to get to that place, and some realistic pressures coming along. Yeah.
Cool. So what's your advice for staff working with liar kids? What worked?
Don't give up. That's really the key. The good liar kid is really good at pushing people away. Like, they're just really good at, like, closing relationships and ending relationships, you know, a lot of time because they've just been hurt by relationships, particularly relationships with adults, right? So, yeah, of course you're going to do that. That's a great barrier. The thing they never expect is empathy and compassion towards their lying or their pushing away, you know, having realistic expectations of them when you keep coming back. When you say you're going to do something and you do it repeatedly, consistently, that's pretty valuable. Because, again, it's being objective and taking a moment to think about who you're working with. You've all got access to files and terrible stories. You start piecing those things together, you can kind of get an idea of why people act the way that they do. So, yeah, be clear with who you're working with, and don't stop trying, regardless of the frustration. It's your job, so,
yeah.
You know, just do it.
Yeah. Cool. I'll switch gears a little bit and talk about your journey to where you are now and why. Why social work?
Great question, Jeff.
What brought you to base camp?
What brought me
12
to base
years
camp?
Ago?
Well, it all goes back to 1992. Actually, probably like 1990. 91. I don't know. A long time ago. I started attending Big Cove YMCA camp in Nova Scotia as a camper. And then I went as a leadership one, which was all hard skill. Wilderness skill tracking, tripping development. And then leadership 2, which was all the soft skill council work with kids stuff. And then I became a staff there. And through, that was over a period of, I don't know, 8 years, say. Met a lot of really great people. Like, my best friends are from there. But also had some really great counselors. And I actually did an interview for CBC when they were going to close the camp a long time ago. And CBC came out and said, you know, was asking questions about, like, what are your greatest influences and how did you get here? And talking about taking the greatest qualities of the individuals that I had worked with or who had worked with me as counselors and saying, oh, I want to be like that person. I, you know, but really appreciating the fact that they were helping kids, right? So that when I became a counselor at camp, I had taken on those ways of being, those ways of teaching, and those ways of, like, just being a good person towards kids who needed it. Because I grew up in not always the best circumstances, and really, you know, I think was looking for good role models in that regard. So when I could be a good role model to somebody that I felt was possibly experiencing the same difficulties or hardships, that was really exciting for me. You know, I always attached myself to the kids that were the most challenging at camp because it was just a natural direction for me. I moved to Edmonton in... I worked at some Y camps in BC from, like, 99 to 2001. I moved to Edmonton in 2001 and started working in inner city boys and girls programs there, and actually doing a YTA type program, semi-independent living, with some very tough children in the inner city of Edmonton, a lot of meth addiction and solicitations and whatnot, at a young age, completely unprepared and putting myself in situations that I should not have been putting myself into because of caring. Yeah, it really progressed from there. So going back actually from camp, Dylan Ostervold had worked at Big Cove and gone to Big Cove, and we'd become friends after not liking each other much over an earlier period of time, became great friends. And he was working at base camp at Enviros, and I was wanting to move from Edmonton to Calgary, and he said, oh, why don't you come work for Enviros? And that's how I started at Enviros. So this whole, I think the interesting thing about this is YTA for me is very much, you know, minus the full wilderness experience of camp, very much one-to-one. You know, like, there's a lot of one-to-one relationship stuff going on at camp, at least when you're reaching out to the difficult kids who are more ostracized and, you know, pushed out or pushing themselves back from the group. Yeah. YTA is like that for me, so, yeah.
Cool. And what what's kept you at Enviros for 12 years?
What has kept me at Enviros for 12 years? I think... I really like Enviros. I really like what it stands for in regards to helping young people and families. There's lots of programs that help young people and families. But in starting at Enviros in 2004, it was a very wilderness-based agency. You know, there was a lot of good natural spirit in the agency, and there was a lot of camaraderie within that. It was a, you know, a very interconnected group of people. Over that time, it's obviously grown into something even bigger, and I would say better as a whole. I think there's obviously been challenges in that growth, as there will be. And one of the biggest challenges, I think, for people that have been here for a long time is that as an agency, company, business, what have you, grows, you lose the interconnectedness, that inherent small town feel where everybody knows everybody and has a decision and everything, and it's very interconnected and democratic and natural. Yeah. Growing into something bigger, you can't do that. There's no time for that, and it's just not. It's not something that comes out as easily. So I think I've enjoyed, while being frustrated at times, that got growth, but still believing in the inherent qualities that I came to love in the first place. I think that it's heading in a great direction, But again, it's challenged by its own realities and the realities of the world around it in Alberta. But I feel like I've got a position where I can be part of that, assisting that change. And I believe in it. And I believe in it because of that, the roots up.
So, and you're in school? Are you done school? You were working on...
I am almost done a Bachelor of Social Work that I've been working on for 9 years distance.
Wow. Fantastic.
I have a month left of math.
Oh.
1 month of math left.
Nice way to wrap it up.
I really wanted to do the math last because I hate it. And but now I enjoy it. I have a great math professor. It's pretty rad. And yeah, so I'll be a real social worker when I get a piece of paper that says I am shortly.
What stood out from you from that educational journey? Because that's a pretty long time, and you've had lots of formative work experience in that. And I mean, I'm always interested in either the connection or the disconnection between formal education and the actual work.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I'm interviewing fresh out of, 24-year-olds who are fresh out of university.
Super keen.
They've learned all this stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, does that actually align with what you're actually going to be doing day to day?
Yeah.
So what's your perception on
That's a great
education
question.
Versus...
I think it's good to go to school and learn things.
Obviously.
I think that the disconnect between social work learnings and social work doings is huge, because there's really nothing being talked about that helps you deal with pubescent meth addicts. There isn't. And you can't read about that because it's actually a very unique experience.
Yeah.
And it's very taxing and it's terrible and you feel awful and you didn't learn about any of that in school. You didn't learn about getting sworn at repeatedly. Maybe something gets thrown at you. You haven't learned about the actual human nuances of every individual you're ever going to encounter. So I think theory is really great because it gives you a groundwork for whatever sort of belief system you want to incorporate into your daily workings. But you need to be prepared to have it shaken out of you a couple of times, probably. My fortune in having worked for so long before doing school was that I felt ahead of the deception, possibly. I wonder if people come out of school like, oh, I'm going to be a social worker. It's going to be the best. I'm going to help children. It's going to feel great. Like, what sort of deception they really feel when they start getting into a group home, because they start at group homes. And group homes are not like social work school, They're just different.
Yep.
And I wonder if they feel duped.
Well, it might explain some of the high turnover rates.
And the burnout rates and all of those rates. I've appreciated school. I've appreciated the learning. I've appreciated the sort of context that I'm given to the things that I'm actually doing. But again, going back to what I was saying, just taking the inherent qualities of individuals that I appreciated, a lot of the stuff has come really naturally to me because I believe in it and it's what I really wanted to do. So school was kind of a secondary, it's like a requirement, a moving ahead requirement. So yeah, I don't disagree with it. I think it's super valuable and I think it gives great context, but I also think that you need to be in social work for the right reason and be clear about your expectations.
Reflecting back on the school experience, what are the nuggets or what are the pieces that you think were most valuable that gave you the context that was most helpful? Is there a class you took? Is there a theoretical orientation that you've developed?
Well, I did it all distance. This is the big problem with distance education and social work when it's something so interpersonal and you're doing it on a computer, that there was no person. There's no personality within a distance program like that. I did, when I first started supervising, it was right in time with a practicum requirement. So I got to become a new supervisor in a strong practicum format. So really had a good opportunity to analyze my discomforts and successes and abilities and challenges really clearly in doing a practicum while doing and being a supervisor, like starting out as a supervisor. So I think that was really beneficial. It really contextualized what I believed in and what I thought I believed in but didn't, or thought I knew but didn't. I'd say out of the entire experience, that was the best part of it. And respectfully to the distance program, in having to finally being challenged with this math, I was trying to do distance math, it just wasn't working for me. And so I actually had to go to school for this. So out of my 102 credits that I have received, 3 of them will have been in a classroom. And that's actually been super rad, going to school, because you get to sit in a classroom and talk about stuff with people.
Interact with people.
It's neat. Yeah. So social work, school, BSWs, and child and youth care programs are wicked and really assist people in getting a niche and seeing what they're interested in doing. The requirements of understanding what they're doing come from exposing the individual to hardship and challenging group home
being sworn at behavior.
And you need it. I think it's like having a puppy before you have a child, you know, like you should practice some stuff before you have big responsibility.
Yeah.
And I think that social work is the same in that regard.
That's a good analogy.
Yeah.
Always have a puppy first.
Yeah. Just to see.
see if it's right.
Are you good at parenting together?
Yeah. Cool. You're in a leadership role. You're a supervisor for a good chunk of time now.
I guess
we've talked a little bit about the work with the clients, but let's talk a bit about the work with the staff.
Mm-hmm.
How do you take somebody who's got a BSW, fresh out of high school or fresh out of university, and teach them the skills they need? Or, you know, what are the mechanisms that you use to try and dive, like, because part of the goal of this podcast is to give some strategies and tools and resources for the listeners so that they can take it to their practice. So if a supervisor is listening to this, what's your best advice as a supervisor of social workers or YTA workers?
I have the good fortune of having only people that are really experienced and have been sworn at repeatedly over time and have dealt with those things. So they know what they love and they hate, which makes it really easy because they're all, and they truly believe in what they're doing, right? So that's really easy to supervise because we just, you know, I believe in being completely transparent and open and challenged and able to speak with my staff team as required and vice versa. For the newer individuals coming out of school, I think it's super valuable as a supervisor to really take the time to listen to their needs and their experiences and not give a knee-jerk reaction opinion and think about who they are. Just as we are required to think about who these kids are, you need to think about the possible limited experiences of staff and why being sworn at is a really shocking thing for them. Having done this job for a really long time, I'm unfortunately not shocked by a lot of things now, which is useful and bad. But new people to the field they're gonna get hit with things again, like we were saying, that they aren't taught in school because they can't be because they're not.
Professors
can't
swear at their.
It's not tangible. Yeah, the professors can't swear at kids and throw stuff at them because they'll get fired. Yeah, so I think it's really important if you're dealing with new staff to take the time and really do supervision, really like explore their experiences and talk about their feelings, thoughts, needs, whatever, and always be open to talking to them as, you know, whenever possible. obviously it's not always possible. But yeah, we need good people in this field. And if people are deterred from the get-go because they've not had adequate supervision, or they just don't feel heard, or they don't feel supported, then they're going to go away because it's not nurtured and it's not fostered, because it's a challenging field. But it's still, you know, people need to be supported through it, because otherwise they leave, they go away.
Yeah, the work's way too hard to do the work and then not get the support or not get your needs even acknowledged.
Yeah.
By a supervisor.
Well, you can't hear and deal with terrible things and not talk about them, and not talk about how it makes you feel. Well, you can learn to do that later, but you know, like it's the things that I experienced at a young age, like, you know, 25-year-old going into a meth addict teen's apartment, there's no light bulbs because they use them all as pipes. Like, that's a thing.
Yeah,
and I didn't know about that thing, but then I saw that thing and I was in that thing. It's like, holy shit, this is I shouldn't probably be here even. Right? So there's a lot of conversation that needs to happen about anything that makes your staff feel a certain way. And you need to be open to doing that, having that conversation. Yeah.
Cool. Let's talk a bit about theoretical orientation. So Enviros has this idea of EL, mm-hmm. experiential learning, mm-hmm. as being a kind of a core component mm-hmm. of the work. Mm-hmm. What does that look like in YTA? Because it looks different, I think. Obviously, you know, you mentioned the roots of this organization are really in wilderness programming. Mm-hmm. It's really easy to see the link between experiencing something,
sure,
when you're climbing a mountain with a backpack,
yeah, yeah,
and reflecting on that and transitioning or using that to inform,
yeah,
plans in your life. But yeah, what does that look like in a community-based program, or at least in YTA?
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about the accessibility of that experience in wilderness, because my favorite moments, like the quickest EL stories I have, are like, you know, the digging the metaphorical snow pit, or the you're scared of shit on the side of this mountain, but you've dealt with the craziest things ever in your life. So how do they interconnect? EL and YTA, because we're so one-to-one based, everything that we're doing when we're dealing with kids who are scared to talk on the phone professionally or scared to open a bank account, those are very experiential things that we're working with there. And so, you know, making a budget based off of having a certain amount of money for spending on food is a very planned out and intentional thing. So within EL, within YTA, yeah, we'll run our metaphors and whatnot. We'll do all types of different activities, but realistically, what we have time for and what we do is hands-on, hard skill development things.
It's interesting when you mentioned budgeting, because I think immediately to a group we do at base camp, sure, with Monopoly money,
yeah,
and fake budgets essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, we're constructing an activity, yeah, to represent what you guys just have to do.
Yeah, we just give them $1,500 and money, expect, right, them to budget it. Yeah.
Experience, so learning at its finest.
It's much more tangible,
yeah,
when they've blown through and can't pay their rent and are scared to talk on the phone, but they have to call the food bank and they have to figure out how to get there. You've got like five different activities built into one, conveniently. So yeah, our EL is very, it can be very quick. It can be very needs driven. Like, oh, today, okay, you do need to get to court for your child custody, you know, whatever. So it's got super value, and it doesn't necessarily, it's rarely a group activity. It's rarely a sit down activity unless you are budgeting. But even then, we've got enough things to do out in the community budget base that it's usually traveling out and around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Which is cool. It's interesting, having come from base camp. We had lots of great activities, super fun, working with the female young offender types. Again, they're in custody, so where are they going to go? So lots of activities there. And even working with foster parents and, you know, helping them, you know, create some metaphors around their disconnect between their foster kids' behavior and their own experience, right? Like, so it's cool to have that background and those things, but direct them into really tangible, accessible, real life circumstance for those transitioning to adulthood.
Yeah. Cool. What else informs the work? Or so there's hands-on, experiential, not giving up on kids, chasing the liars around.
Yeah.
But is there any theoretical framework or anything that YTA has really latched on to as something else that informs the lens? So I think that that's part of, I mean, what we all develop as professionals, but I think programs have inherent lenses on on your role and how you do that role.
Yeah. We, as a whole, are very strength-based and will always, even if my staff team is incredibly frustrated with one particular individual, my first comment is, okay, but what are they? How is that a transferable skill? You know, yes, they're dealing drugs, so that means that, well, maybe they're a good drug dealer or they're a bad drug dealer, you know? So is that a transferable skill? So what are their strengths? What are they doing well? Where are their successes? Just maintaining that positive outlook on the work that we do. You know, definitely some CBT type modality in what we do with, like, how to open a bank account and go stand in that lineup and wait till your turn to talk to a person that's going to get you to sign some stuff, right? Like, I remember particularly like one client who, he was terrified of the idea of this. Like, so all we did the first time was drive to the bank and we sat outside and talked about what goes on inside the bank and then we left. And the next time we drove and we went inside the foyer to the bank machine and I think I took some money out for myself and showed him not my password, but, you know, that's a thing. And then we called and booked an appointment to speak with a professional to open a bank account, et cetera, right? So just, like, exposing them to...
It's exposure therapy. Very exciting. Yeah.
Right? Just sort of that thing. It really depends. We're all over the place with what we do because every single circumstance is very dynamic and unique. Yeah.
So it sounds like very client-centered and individual.
So individualized and so client-led. You know, we have the things that we try to undo regularly are caseworkers who decide what goes on the case plan because who cares? Because it's not the caseworker's case plan, it's the kid's case plan, so you should probably write about their stuff in their language, maybe even imagine that. And so we really try and keep it really client-led, and that's the beauty of having a their own buy-in, client buy-in. They can choose to be in the program or they
voluntary.
Can choose to be voluntary. Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, they get to lead it. That being said, there are, you know, chasing the liars, so to speak, right? Like, we do commit to staying with them. And if they say that they're interested but they disappear for months on a time, we still try and remain focused on them.
Yeah.
But very client-driven. Very individualized.
Cool.
Yeah.
It sounds, I mean, to some degree, it's the same across the agency. We're all working with the same kids at different stages in their development. And so it's good to hear that, you know, the Basecamp way and the YTA way sounds pretty similar.
Mm-hmm.
Looks different in practice.
Yeah.
But similar guiding philosophies and similar.
Yeah. Well, and again, that's another thing. Like, I've heard of other agencies that they don't necessarily buy into that, those sort of methods, that sort of individualized belief, that sort of client-centered, client-driven belief system, right? Which, okay, if you, sure, yeah. But I don't agree with it. So that's another thing that definitely keeps me within the agency, too, is it just a general guided philosophy.
Yeah, it's interesting. We thought we were being really client-centered for the longest time, and then we revamped the outcome tool that we were using and personal plans.
Mm-hmm.
Actually took out the word case plan because they're not a case, they're a person.
Yeah.
And so we changed it to personal plans.
Nice one.
It's about you.
Yeah.
And changed the language, so it was very, we clientified the language.
Mm-hmm.
And started reflecting the outcomes back to the clients so that they could see their progress or their lack of progress, and we could have a conversation about that.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you're sitting around in case consultation. It's almost like the client is there because their personal plan, their outcomes are the focus of our conversation.
Yeah.
And for the longest time, we thought we were being client-centered by simply talking about clients.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, we're still full of our own professional biases around what they should and shouldn't be doing, what the problem really is.
Yeah.
And so to insert the client voice into our process wherever possible has dramatically shifted.
Yeah.
What we thought was client-centered wasn't. And we're closer to that now. Still never going to get there. Anytime you've got a professional that their job is to write notes on the client, you may introduce that bias. And so it's been an interesting process for us.
Well, and for kids who've been in care for a really long time, and you hand them another form, you say, we're having another meeting about you and the things you need to do with, and we're going to be strangers or people you don't really invest any patience or time with, but we're going to tell you what to do. Yeah, I think that's a really great strategy to make it more about them. And
well, we've seen it both anecdotally and in the hard data that it works better.
Yeah.
And so it's getting to the point where, like, well, why wouldn't you do this? The field at large, psychology, counseling, whatever, is saying the more client-centered you are, the more effective you are.
Yeah.
I think it was Scott Miller who said that the average grandmother is as effective as the average psychologist.
Right.
Makes you question not just BSWs, but masters and PhDs.
Yeah, well, but again, I think that it's like that goes back to how we think of these kids, right? How we make a job of this and how we know and they don't, right? It doesn't work. It's not appropriate to their way of being. It doesn't fit. So, no, I think that making it as focused on them and their language and their experience and their story, that's how it's going to work. And that shift, I think, is coming. It's, like you're talking about it, we're talking about it, and I'm really excited about that possibility because it will only benefit, it'll make it easier for the people that are working with these people, but for the people, their lives will be richer and fuller in that regard.
Cool. So if you had a magic wand and you could change something about the system, what would it be? What would be your first kind of the easiest go-to? What's one thing that every professional listening to this should embrace, should incorporate, should research? Nothing but small questions on that.
Yeah, that's a really good one. The magic wand will, I think this is child and family service related for myself. I think it will create a system that is more inclusive to the needs of the individual. It will not bounce kids through multiple caseworkers at the very beginning. You had some of these kids that are like, a new caseworker every couple months. The workers won't have 40 some odd kids on their caseloads to deal with. Their various work sites will have the same policies consistently throughout the region. And I think those are the tangible things. Ideally, kids are supported and never need to come into care and ever have problems. But we all need to work. So I think that we'll remain employed. I think that more money needs to be given, more money that doesn't exist needs to be given to group homes and group home staff, because as we've talked about through this whole thing, they have sometimes the hardest time with the kids because they have the least experience and frequently the hardest clients to work with. So you need to either A, have money to pay individuals who are really good at that, or B, have money to pay for training that will assist these individuals in becoming really good at that.
Or just an extra staff at some days.
And you should probably have a bunch of staff, yes.
When I look at the discrepancy between the funding of addiction and mental health type programs, voluntary treatment versus group homes, oftentimes they're single staffed or double staffed to 6 or 8highest needs kids.
Yeah.
And we've got 5 staff or 6 staff on the floor in other programs. It's just doesn't make sense.
It's unsafe and dumb. It's really terrible because, like, in having been in those situations, like, I've never, you know, I didn't have to experience anything overly challenging. Well, they're relative. But, yeah, you shouldn't have a bunch of teenagers, like, eight of them and two staff in a over-custody facility.
Brand new out of school.
Who are brand new out of school. And maybe they don't even work there regularly. Maybe they're relief.
Yeah.
I think that that's dangerous for everybody.
Yeah.
And I think that it's negligent. And not just from our own agency, but as a whole being.
The whole system.
Yeah.
Cool. What are some go-to resources, books, things that you've read that have really influenced your life? I like to give people some things that they can go away and take some action, and if grabbing a book off Amazon and reading it might help shift some things.
I think everybody should read Lord of the Flies and Basketball Diaries and what are some other not books that you're expecting right now? You know, a lot of the Gabor Mate stuff. I don't read a lot of the theological type books and the social work. My textbooks didn't open a lot through my career of school, but I do believe that Gabor Mate is a really smart individual who says great things that are applicable across the line, even when he's talking about adults with addiction. That's very transferable.
But I would say his In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts.
Yeah, that's a
mandatory reading for being human.
Pretty sweet book if you want to hear about terrible things and have some context around some pretty near realities. Or, actually, you know what? Don't even read a book. Take a trip to Vancouver and drive through the Lower East Side. Or better yet, walk through the Lower East Side and just sit on a bench for a little while. That will teach you things, for sure. But I would really say that out of every single book I've ever read regarding youth and youth experience, Lord of the Flies is my absolute favorite.
I'm gonna have to pick it up again. I haven't read it probably since
it is, high school. And that's the problem, is everybody did some papers on it in grade 11 English and stopped reading it after that. But if you go back to it, it is the perfect. Well, no, it's not perfect. It's a great example of group dynamics in teenage boys. And that can be applied, although differently, with teenage girls.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good suggestion.
Yeah.
Out of left field. That's good.
Out of left field, yes.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
What's next for you? You're going to finish up school? You're going to...
Yeah. I'm going to finish school.
Rock in YTA?
I'm going to finish school, stay in YTA for a little while. I don't know. I'm trying to become more involved with... the agency as a whole, be more focused in my leadership role and its effects globally, per se, trying to get more engaged in direct presentation and facilitation, because it's something that's always scared me and I'm tired of feeling that way, and I think I'm actually better than I probably give myself credit for, so I want to do more of that. Yeah, and I actually would really like to make this year much more wilderness focused for our clients. It's really hard, again, when you're not in a group setting, to drag a group of kids into the wilderness.
Yeah. Coordinate a bunch of...
Yeah, well, and they've got jobs and they've got school and they've got life. Like, they live in different places. They live on their own.
Yeah.
So they're not always motivated to go into the mountains and do stuff. But I would really like to make that a bigger... focus this year for us, because every time we've done it, it's been great. It's just that our numbers are low, which is actually all right too, to have low numbers, because it just makes it much more individualized and specific to the client. But exposure to more is better. Yeah, that's what I want to do in the next little while.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. I look forward to watching that and seeing that.
I look forward to sharing it with you, Jeff.
Anything else top of mind? Anything we didn't cover? Covered some ground. But if there's something that's I didn't ask, a question I didn't ask, something that you want to share?
If you're feeling frustrated as a worker in the social services field, talk to some people, take some time, figure out why you're frustrated. Yes, I do have one. Objectivity. Be objective about who it is you're dealing with and what it is you're feeling, and try and take yourself out of the situation and explore the whole scenario, and it'll really benefit you as a whole worker person. Because we very quickly attach our feelings and emotions to bad things or frustrating things and whatnot, and that is not overly useful in working with youth at all.
Yeah. I'll second that. We've been working a lot with nonviolent communication,
mm-hmm.
and the very first premise or the very first core idea is observation without evaluation and judgment.
Mm.
And we're so quick, especially as helping professionals, I think we attach a lot of our sense of self and identity into the work.
Well, we've got all the ideas.
Exactly. And yeah, it's an interesting one to be like, try and be as objective as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Take your subjectiveness out of it,
yeah.
and see what happens. I think it's...
Well, and it's a very useful skill to have in one's general life,
yeah.
you know? Like, in the just the relationships that you have or the world that you live in as an individual, regardless of whether you're a worker person or not, is to actually just be objective. Take yourself out of it. Try and have a full vision without any expectation or opinion or whatnot, yeah.
yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
That's great advice and a great place to wrap it up.
Great.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast with Chris Sullivan, supervisor at our Youth Transitions to Adulthood program. I'll remind you to check out www.enviros.org. We've got a big gala event coming up in October with Olympian Clara Hughes. It's going to be a great event, so I encourage you to check that out. Thanks, and we'll talk to you soon.